The views expressed by the host or hosts in this show do not necessarily represent those of our clients, sponsors, partners, or guests, and should not be considered investment advice in any way. Similarly, the views and opinions of our guests and clients do not necessarily reflect those of our hosts or our platform. Nothing shared on this platform or any other platform affiliated with us should be read and construed as constituting investment advice of any kind on the part of Insider Exchange, any of its hosts, guests, partners, or sponsors. Trading and investing carry varying levels of risk and may not be suitable for all investors. Please ensure that you fully understand the risks and take appropriate care to manage your risk. We strongly advise that you obtain independent financial, legal, and tax advice from regulated professionals and institutions before proceeding with investment decisions.
Let's get the show on the road.
Sad story. 98, our currency's collapsing. I'm in Mozambique. I pull out a dollar. They're like, no, we don't take off.
I would certainly have the champagne in the fridge and definitely cool.
On ice.
Chilled.
Always been of the view that we need a sovereign wealth fund in South Africa.
Oh, the space industry in the free.
As you secure the bag.
I'm Jimmy Maya.
And I'm Simon Brown.
Welcome to Insider Exchange.
Hello and welcome to yet another episode of Insider Exchange. Welcome to Market Matters, live streamed for your viewing pleasure every Monday morning. Of course, with the rest of the show set to drop later in the week. If you're joining us via chat, if you're joining us via live stream, shout out to our TikTok community. We'd love to have you guys engage with us. Let us know your thoughts, share your opinions, and generally just say hi. We miss hearing from you guys sometimes. On the show today, we are going to be taking a look at some of the developments that have taken place over the last week. We're going to be reflecting on the appointment of the BlackRock CEO, Larry Fink, as co-chair of the World Economic Forum. Also going to be taking a look at some other developments from markets that have been out in the week. In particular, we're going to be focusing on numbers that are coming out this week. We've got results from the likes of Sasol and Nvidia, both locally and internationally, that we want to take a look at. So that's what's coming up on our show from a Market Matters perspective. In our deep dive, we're going to be diving into the Jackson Hole Symposium. We're going to be reflecting on that, reviewing our thoughts around that particular gathering, and we're going to see what we make of the recent policy shift from the US Fed. And then, of course, in Investor Insights, we're going to wrap things up with some very interesting information around some of the other things that we've been picking up in the media space. And we're going to update our wall and provide you with an unfiltered opinion. So stick around for those. Obviously, those are coming through later in the week. But let's get into the show. Before we get into the show, we've gotten past the Irish names. We're now on to Scottish names. And again, there was a technical mishap with yours. So yours should actually be spelt C-A-L-D-E-R. I don't know how that came out.
Calder. I got paddle with a C.
You got paddle with a C. But yes, Calder is one of the names, seemingly one of the simpler names. I got E-A-C-H-A-N, which is each with an A-N at the end. But that's not how you say it. And I've been trying to rack my brain around how to say it. And it seems as though it's something to the effect of Echen.
Sure.
So Scottish names is what we're moving on to, because we kind of exhausted the Irish ones. We went through all the difficult ones. So we're going to keep seeing if we can keep finding the difficult names. Let us know if you have suggestions and thoughts around what we should put next on other cups. And if you find a name that we probably haven't used or haven't tried, let us know that as well. Before we get into Market Matters, Si, public service announcement, not on my behalf, but apparently the people out there would probably want to know this. The Swifties have won.
What did they win?
Taylor Swift is now officially the biggest artist, or the wealthiest artist,
and no one is surprised,
in the world. That means wealthier than Beyonce, wealthier than Rihanna. So for context, Rihanna is, or actually let's perhaps start with Beyonce, because she would rank third on this list according to Forbes. Beyonce's net worth is $760 million. This is according to Forbes, folks, not my numbers. I didn't make this up. Rihanna's estimated net worth is around $1.4 billion. Taylor Swift comes in at $1.6 billion. Now, what's even more astounding around that is 1.6
She's more than 2 billion,
but sure. More than two Beyoncés. Don't say that to the Beehive. We're not going to spark an international incident here, folks. We're just sharing the numbers that Forbes put out. Beehive, please don't come after us. Swifties, please don't go after the Beehive. Please don't make this ugly. We're just giving numbers. We're just the numbers people. Please leave us alone. So yes, Taylor, oddly enough, the interesting fact around the 1.6 billion is she's become possibly one of the first artists, and I want to just check if this is... So she's officially the richest female musician as a result of this, right?
Oh, male.
But she's also the first singer to earn $1 billion from her music alone. She's earned $1.2 billion of the $1.6 billion net worth from her music collection.
And that includes that insane tour that she did.
Yes.
Yeah.
And buying back her masters and her catalog and all of that stuff. So that's all we're going to say on that matter. Again, please, Beehive, please, Swifties, leave us out of it. We're just the numbers people. Let's get into market matters because there's a lot to dive into. There's a lot that has been taking place. We know that we've got a couple of numbers coming out this week and we'll get back to those. But I want us to start with an overview just perhaps of, let's start with Larry, CEO of BlackRock, the largest asset manager on the planet by a long shot, appointed as co-chair of the World Economic Forum. Now, for context, the World Economic Forum was founded by a gentleman named Klaus Schwab. No relation, interestingly enough, to Charles Schwab. But yes, Klaus Schwab founded this and has stepped down as of April of this year as the chair. And in his place, we now get two co-chairs. And one of those is Larry Fink. Surprised?
Yeah. I mean, yes. I mean, the flip side, I mean, what does the World Economic Forum do apart from Davos and some reports and the like? I am surprised, I think. I just suppose they are the World Economic Forum, I suppose, having the man who basically runs asset management the world over. Mm. Yeah, stick him on. Okay. Yeah, fair enough, I guess.
What does that mean, though, for the world? Because for BlackRock, that already effectively controls a lot of the world and is invested in a lot of the world, to now have a say at possibly one of the biggest gatherings of global leaders or one of the biggest Swiss parties. I don't really know. I've never been to Davos. Maybe one day someone will invite us.
In the olden days, SAFM used to present from Davos.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh.
Who was it back then? I can't even remember. But certainly, anyway, and then they changed the rules. But who wants to be cold in
January? I don't
know
if they changed the rules or if it became a financial headache.
Yeah. But who wants to be cold in January? So I mean, I take your point, absolutely. But I think we've moved past that in terms of worries around conflicts of interest and who's running the show.
Or certain people don't have conflicts of interest apply to them.
Yeah, or should foxes run the hen house? I mean, I really think we've moved past that. Yeah. I mean, I would certainly think it should raise an eyebrow, but
Well, I mean, you're not the CEO of a multi-$1 trillion asset manager.
Correct.
So,
and nor have I ever been to a World Economic Forum event.
See? So actually,
I'm 0-2.
Well, there we go. Perhaps the organizers of the World Economic Forum would love to have us there. We'd do our show from there. I think we could do a great show from there covering Davos next year.
No, do they have someone like somewhere like, do they do like
Hawaii? Somewhere warmer.
Maybe Brazil.
Somewhere with a beach.
Yeah. I'm thinking like that. Like Cape Town. I don't know. Cape Town in summer.
I forgot Sai's love for beaches is unmatched and unprecedented. While we are looking at other things, before we get into the company results that are coming out this week, I want to reflect on some updates. We have previously covered some of these conversations in the past, and we're just providing a bit of context and a bit of updates around that. Last week, the most recent update, last week we covered the GP... It was last week or the week before. We covered the GPAA, the Pension Funds Administration Agency. They were said to be involved in R1 billion worth of leases that didn't really make sense.
The ghost buildings.
Yes. So the ghosts contracts, right? Interestingly enough, the Government Employees Pension Fund, the GEPF, has come out to express that they're concerned around that particular statement. I mean, who knew? It only took us having a concerned conversation for the GEPF to realize that they should be concerned about it. I'm sure people were concerned about it from the onset, but it's nice to finally see that someone is worried about us spending R1 billion of taxpayers or pensioners' funds on leases that don't really make sense.
Yeah, the question is, the skeptics were always going to be, concerns are nice, but they don't, you know, does anything happen? Does the contract get pulled, or does someone get fired, or does they get keys to the building? Because by all accounts, they need a building, and it met many of the requirements, except for the access part.
It needed to be within
500 meters of a public transport. All of those were cool. You couldn't access.
It wasn't your building to do.
Well, yeah, that was a complex. But yeah, I mean, it's only fair that steps in and says, you know,
what's going on?
What is happening?
Interestingly enough, while we're looking at things that are being questioned here and responsibilities being taken, I covered a story on the radio show last week around CETAs, you know, the training authorities and all of that. There's a research report that was done by a couple of smart people along with the Bureau for Economic Research that suggests that over the 13 years or so that they've looked at, the last 13, dating back to, I think, 2012, 2012-ish, CETAs have received from the Skills Development Levy 165 billion rand with a B.
Wow.
And what do we have to show for it? Now, there's about 21 CETAs in the country at the moment.
Yeah.
And most of those are undergoing reshuffle. Most of those are undergoing changes in terms of leadership and board changes and all of that. And I can't help but wonder, is that enough accountability or not? But I mean, 165 billion over 13 years, told you, no one can spend it like South Africa can. And we have no problem generating
it. Yeah, and the idea of CETAs is a really good thing. And I mean, that's about 13 billion a year. It's a billion a month. It's a lot of cash.
It's a lot of money.
I would argue that we're not really seeing it very much. Just, well, I mean, I don't know. Where are our lower unemployment, higher GDP numbers, which is in large part what CETAs are designed for, right?
So, you want some stats on the CETAs? Of that 165 odd billion rand, around 2.6 million people have registered for the CETAs. Only 2 million have completed. So, less than 3 million people.
And I need to do some math because this is too many zeros
okay,
for my head.
While you do the math, I'll give you the next update. The next update is Murray and Roberts. We had previously covered Murray and Roberts as a suspended chair in one of our segments when we were looking at Murray and Roberts on the wall, and as part
56, of 56,000 per person. That's a year at Wits.
56,000 per person.
169 billion divided by 3 million.
169 billion.
Divided by 3 million people.
Oh, divided by 3 million people. Okay, okay.
56,000 a person.
Yeah, okay. That sounds right.
Yeah, that's a Wits degree.
Yes.
Well, first year, but.
Well, I mean, again, if you ask the 2.6 million people that have registered for these, whether or not they got that in terms of quality of outcome, that's a different conversation. But nevertheless, we are spending the money. As South Africa, we are spending the money.
Back to Murray and Roberts.
Back to Murray and Roberts. They have officially closed. After 120 years in South Africa and listed on the JSE, we now no longer have a Murray and Roberts. We still have, or may not have, a construction mafia, which we won't get into because we don't want to upset anybody out there.
So they sold one of their businesses to Differential Capital, which is wild because they're a hedge fund management. And they do, I've chatted with one or two of the guys there, they do epic stuff. Like they count cars going to shopping centers and stuff like that. Anyway.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah. Well, maybe it's somebody else. Anyway, they do epic stuff in that regard. So Murray and Roberts, my dad worked for them in the 70s.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. He built a couple of things. One of them was a coal mine somewhere in northern KZN, airport in Gaborone, amongst things. It is. There was a really good article on Currency News. I think Julieta Talivi, Rob Rose, I think, wrote a couple of months back, basically throwing the current management under the bus and saying they did it, you know, the old managers coming back and throwing the new managers, which is a little bit, but I mean, truthfully, the peak for construction in this country post 94 was World Cup, and they all made giant profits. And we know how they did that, right? Collusion.
So,
if your peak profit requires collusion, and then they all go offshore and stuff. And the thing with being a construction company is your margins are tiny. Mm. Your edge is skills. So, you know, if I'm a good, I don't know, bridge or road builder or something like that, then you can, you know, grab those skills are movable. I think I've told the story before. In the 70s, my dad and his team bought out a German engineer for something. And like we all went to meet them at the airport in Durban because it was so exciting. Because, I mean, to be clear, how did you find a German engineer in the 70s? I mean, who did you write a letter to?
Well, it wasn't to a gentleman in Adolf. So no. Thankfully.
And there's no LinkedIn. There's no, I mean,
there's,
I don't
yeah,
know
yeah. There's you, no Facebook. There's no but, social
so,
media.
So, those skills are infinitely movable. And so then everyone went offshore, South America, North America, Asia, Brazil. And what did you do when you went there? Well, you find all your South African companies there and all the other companies, Chinese, Italian, etc., also in that market and the existing people. And your edge is either your technical ability, which is commoditized, or price, which is bye-bye margins. And it has been the globalization of construction. Just, I don't know where your edge is anymore.
It's very interesting because now, I used to think that perhaps your edge would lie in your order book. But in looking at that, even if you pipeline an order book, you end up in a situation where you're having to sell off your Australian business because something else is not performing well. You know, I mean, this has happened in the construction space.
Yeah, and order books, and I did this a long time ago, so it might be out of date. I maybe did this a decade ago. I went back, you know, every year they tell you what their order book is and their results, and then
so pipeline for the new year. Yeah,
I took those numbers and I rolled them into future revenue.
Mm. Mm. Mm.
So the world's largest construction company is China State Construction Engineering Corporation. Note the state part.
Yes.
Operates in 100 companies.
Well.
Sorry, 100 countries. Other one is the China Railway Group, state-owned. China Railway Construction Corp, state-owned. And then French Vinci.
What was the largest one you said, China?
The China State Construction Engineering Corporation.
State Construction Engineering Corporation.
Yeah.
That is a very, very long name.
That is a mouthful.
That is a mouthful.
Yeah.
I want to see if they are the ones.
It's all China. And then number five is Vinci. And I don't recognize any of these as listed names.
Well, I saw something quite interesting that said that there was a point where I think 9 out of the decision makers in the People's Republic of China government at some point, I saw very briefly, I think it was this morning on my way here, are engineers. And so Chinese leadership is almost hardwired to build. And it's quite interesting because now you're saying, you're bringing up these numbers and it
usually
supports that.
So in politics and corporates, it's usually CAs. In politics, it's usually lawyers. Yeah, I know.
Not in China. In China, have engineering qualifications, amongst other things. Possibly some of them are doctors, mathematicians. Mm-hmm. I doubt if any of them are lawyers. That'd be interesting to see.
Does China have? They must have lawyers.
They should have lawyers.
I know nothing about the Chinese legal system, except that when you get guilty, they take you outside and shoot you. No questions.
Don't be.
Bang, bang.
Don't be found guilty in China, lest you want to find yourself on the receiving end of bang, bang. Okay, let's wrap things up with a look at this week.
Yeah.
Markets are doing well. Everybody is floating on a cloud at the moment.
All-time highs, ching, ching.
That's it. Despite the fact that we are seeing a significant policy shift from the US Fed, which could have disastrous impacts on the market. That's what's coming up in the deep dive, so tune in for that later in the week. But today, we have Sasol results out.
Yeah.
And later this week, we have CrowdStrike, and more importantly, NVIDIA.
So the Sasol numbers, not bad. And I mean, I'm currently holding Sasol because I'm finally, it broke my technical level. I know you've been there, you've already doubled your money. I'm so to the party. That cash flow, free cash flow, 12 billion versus 7. That was a big number. That was a big number.
Well, it helps to get a 4 billion injection from...
semantics, an absolutely big number. Mm. CrowdStrike, NVIDIA is the big one. See, here's what the folks must look for. It is Wednesday. Is it after market close? It usually is.
Should be after market. Yeah.
I think NVIDIA is usually
Wednesday.
After market.
Wednesday the 27th.
After market. Earnings per share, they're looking for year on year to be up around, where are we? There we go. Second quarter, around 48%. So that's earnings per share. They need to be that quarter on quarter up 25%. And sales up 53% year on year. Interestingly, only up about 4% quarter on quarter. But basically, they're looking to increase sales by call it 50%.
My question is, how does the market, and I suppose we'll only really know on Wednesday or Thursday-ish, whether NVIDIA hits or misses, the market doesn't react the way we think it should.
Yeah, look, unless
it's a wild miss,
unless
perhaps?
They do, it's a wild miss or a wild beat. You know, if they do 25 instead of 50, or if they do 75 instead of 50, but if they just, you
if
know,
they do 52, then it's just like, oh, well, now you've let us down because you've hit 50% and above.
So what I'm looking for there, and it's small in their world, but I'm looking for two things. One is their sales of those H20s to China, because remember they had to write them down because they couldn't sell them. Then they could maybe sell them, but they got to give 15% to Trump. Whoever.
To someone.
So that's interesting. And then the second thing is Jensen Huang keeps on talking about how the next big thing is automotive, and I want to see how that's coming along. So it's self-driving cars. They've got chips that do all of that. I'm interested how, because we know how the AI is doing.
They're building supercomputers for everything, aren't they?
Correct, Amando.
So, NVIDIA results coming out later this week. Sasol results out today. CrowdStrike results out as well. These are all stocks we've had on our wall of preferred picks. Not financial advice, folks, just our thoughts around those stocks. We will see how the numbers continue to unfold and see what we update from that perspective. But this is where we're going to leave our market matters. Thanks, folks, for joining us. Thank you for jumping onto our chats and letting us know that you are with us. If you missed any of the conversation, don't worry about it. It pops up in the live tab on our YouTube channel after this conversation, and the rest of the show obviously will be dropped later in the week. But for now, that's Market Matters. And we move on to our deep dive. We're diving into the Jackson Hole Symposium that took place this past week. If you're just joining us on our YouTube channel, folks, there is a live stream section that happens every Monday morning that is then put up under our live tab. So we welcome you to the second part of our conversation. If you're joining us from our audio podcast, thanks for sticking around. We know that you guys love to listen to us for extended periods of time. But yes, let's get straight into the deep dive. We are diving into the Jackson Hole Symposium. It takes place every single year in the United States. And a brief overview of this is it is a gathering that the U.S. Federal Reserve uses as a platform to give strategic insights as to where it is they're going from a policy direction perspective and to get the thoughts of perhaps other central bank leaders from around the world if they take those thoughts into consideration. I suppose the U.S. does a lot of the things that they do on their own. But nevertheless, Fetcher Jerome Powell on Friday kicked off Jackson Hole and addressed the gathering by saying that the U.S. Fed is shifting their policy.
Yeah. So there's always a theme at Jackson Hole. And the theme this year is like jobs and AI and productivity and all of that. Lovely. But it was Jerome Powell's, his last speech as Fed chair. Mm. Because of course, he steps down in May. He's got another 2 years of his term as a Fed member, as a voting member, but his chair ends in May. And he basically said, let's not worry about inflation. Let's worry about jobs. Now, a couple of points. There's still two more, which the market took to mean rate cut in September and December. Some people are even saying one in November as well. Mm. But remember, the Fed has a dual mandate. One is price stability, aka inflation, and the other is full employment. And we've certainly seen some weakness in employment number, but was that one-off? Trump fired the head of the BLS. So that's not going to change much. But the thing is, it's quite the shift because they've been worrying about inflation. But I think there are two things around why they've taken their eye off the ball of inflation. And the first is that certainly tariffs are proving to be inflationary, but they're coming through spotty.
Yes.
Like there's tariffs and then they get 90 days and then there's tariffs here and not there. So tariffs are coming through spotty. It's not coming through all at one time. Now they've raised, last number I saw, they were raising $40-odd billion a month from tariffs. That is a direct tax on the American consumer, but nice and spotty. So that's not hurting. And the other thing with tariffs is it's a one-off inflation hit. In other words, if your inflation comes, it jumps. You're not going to get a doubling of the tariff next year. So now it's in the base. Wayne McCurry would have always told you the best thing for inflation is inflation. It goes up. It's now in the base. The point is low inflation doesn't mean stuff goes down. It just means it goes up slower.
Mm.
So they've taken the eye off inflation and they're saying no worries. Normally, dropping rates in a raising inflation environment, people are throwing stagflation around, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah, maybe, but people have been throwing that word around for 20-odd years. There's another point to it and the Fed has never said this. Alex Dayson Thimble Wolf mentioned it on my show this morning. Maybe the Fed doesn't mind a 2.5% or 3% inflation. It's quite a bit above their target. But remember, inflation deflates your debt away.
Mm.
So if you run inflation at, say, 3% instead of 1.5%, and I'm just picking two random numbers, your debt pile, of which America has quite the pile.
$34 trillion of that.
Which is 12 zeros.
Which is increasing as well. The debt ceiling has now been bumped up to $40 trillion, I think.
I forget now. But the point being is that it deflates that away. Mm. Our debt in South Africa, how do we manage our debt? Well, there's two ways. Three ways you pay for it. And the other is inflation and currency weakness.
Mm.
So there is a world in which maybe the Fed's like, So it was a pivot. Did he bow to pressure from Trump? I can't think that Jerome Powell bows to pressure from anyone except maybe his wife and his kids. And I think he's just saying, hang on, we're not so stressed by the inflation thing. Mm-hmm. We think it's, and I'm going to use the word again, transitory.
Mm-hmm.
Look how that worked last time. Let's rather focus on jobs, because that jobs data report was a little ugly.
So before we get into the jobs data and that, I want to just emphasize the significance of the shift. Now, Fed Chair Jerome Powell in the past has come out, even as far back as the pandemic and coming out of the pandemic, his concern has always been the labor force, the average work compensation rate. So the average hourly rate that employees in the U.S. are being paid, the level of employment that's there. So his concern has always been sort of a balanced approach. So for him, as the Fed chair, this isn't a policy shift in itself, because it's not the first time he's been worried about jobs. But what is significant, and I think this is what the market is trying to read into, is for the U.S. Fed to suddenly say, after months of saying interest rates are going to be dependent on inflation, to suddenly say, hang on, inflation can wait. Quite literally, inflation can take a back seat, because if we don't address the jobs situation, we could find ourselves in a situation where unemployment increases or something worse happens and the US economy goes into a recession. Now, to be clear, the stagflation term that Cy mentioned earlier is increasing unemployment that is coinciding with increasing inflation. Now, that is likely an inevitability in the US at the current state, given the data that's coming out. The question then becomes, and this is probably the all-important question around the US economy, is at what point does the tipping point kind of get reached? At what point is it too much? And now we're on the other side of the equation where we're rescuing an economy. Because for now, up until they've been able to keep recession conversations off the table. But if history is anything to go by, this exact policy shift is the same policy shift we saw in 2000, just before the dot-com bubble burst. It's the same policy shift we saw in 2008, just before the 2008 financial crisis. And markets in both cases have reacted exactly the same as what they're reacting to now. They've gone up a little bit more before capitulating and coming down. Now, this is, again, what Fed Chair Jerome Powell aims to avoid. And I think you've mentioned this sign in the past, where you've said that for all of the Fed chairs that we've seen in the US, Jerome Powell is the first one to come out and say openly they hope they've learned from the mistakes of the past, which therefore suggests that perhaps that is what might be going on here. Whether history will repeat itself or not is the massive question, because if we go into a capitulation in the US economy, all-time highs are gone for all other markets.
On those all-time highs, we need the top here at 100,000.
Yes.
You can do whatever you want.
Then you can do whatever.
Top 40 at 100,000. I have whiskey coming my way, and I got deadlines here. It's got to happen before Christmas.
And we are at 95,400 for context.
Yeah, yeah.
So we're 5%. Almost there. We're on the way there.
And then you can do what you like. So you're right. And the Fed put out a big paper in 2020, looking back at some of their, maybe policy misstep. I forget what they called it. But the mistakes and the new way they were going to look at the world and everything, having learned from the previous year. And then they just threw that away.
And then they didn't learn.
Well, in their defense, they got the highest inflation in 40 years. These documents, play we never spoke type of thing.
Yeah.
There's another argument out there, which may be they're seeing stuff in the unofficial inflation data that speaks to me. Here's what I mean by it. So we get the BLS, Bureau of Labor Stats survey. That comes out. That's lovely, et cetera, et cetera. But the Fed chairs, and there are 12 chairs. Mm-hmm. The Fed chairs spend a lot of time in their areas, their regions, speaking to business, speaking to companies. What are you doing? How's business? How's confidence?
Conversations they didn't have when the Lehman Brothers went under, when Enron was happening, when the 2008 financial crisis happened. Okay, so they've learned in that part at least, I suppose.
Yeah. So they have these conversations with business. Mm-hmm. And the one thing that has come back is that business has been things are a little unsure, so we're being careful with hiring, we've been careful with expansion, et cetera.
Careful with lending from a bank perspective.
And maybe what they've seen unofficially is worse than what's, because some of it is forward looking stuff, like do you plan to employ people in the next 12 months? That's not showing up in the unemployment rate today, that's next year's unemployment rate. So maybe they're just seeing stuff that's kind of got them a little bit spooked.
And I suppose if that is the case, Si, how then do you address it? Because even if you cut rates, that doesn't necessarily equal a silver bullet. That doesn't necessarily suddenly say to employers, hey guys, be less spooked. Because let's be clear, some of the things that are spooking people from hiring, from expanding, particularly in the US, are tariffs,
are coming out of the White House.
That's it, right? So things that are coming out of your domestic environment. So
just to be clear, expropriating without compensation, 11% of Intel might be an example of crazy stuff coming out of the
world. But when other countries talk about that, it's a problem. Anyway, we move swiftly along, right?
We move swiftly along. So, absolutely. And there is, it's the level of uncertainty. And I know, the most overused word during the pandemic was unprecedented. Mm. And now it's all about uncertainty. But if you're a business person and you're uncertain, you be careful. You operate carefully. Does interest rates coming down significantly change that?
Unlikely. I still incur the cost. I still have to worry about the expansion of the business, the operations of the business, the revenues, the profits, all of those sorts of things. And if I'm uncertain as to the direction that my country is headed in under this president, because the president, let's be clear, comes out and says, we're doing this for the benefit of America. And then American businesses come out and say, we don't see the benefit just yet. Perhaps he's a long-term genius. History shown us perhaps perhaps otherwise. And I suppose as a business, these are the concerns, because let's be clear, under previous administrations, you may not have liked what has been said, but at least there was clear direction around...
And that perhaps is the key point.
President Bush was a warring president.
There was a sense of consistency, and that's more than anything. You know, a business operates under all types of environments. They get used to that. What they want is some level of consistency. And what we've had in Trump 2, I mean, to a degree in Trump 1, but certainly in Trump 2, is just like, sure, I mean, consistency is out the window.
And that
makes business uncertain. It also makes labor uncertain. You know, in a strong labor market, you quit your job. Your boss like looks at, won't give you a tea break. And you storm out and go find a new job. And tomorrow you're somewhere else. Suddenly you're not so sure about that. So it does take pressure off wages, which might help inflation. But I mean, the key point is that the Federal Reserve is between a rock and a hard place right now. And I'm not sure. So raising rates is off the table. Cutting them, I'm not sure how it helps. Leaving them unchanged, I suppose you cut them because it gives some sense of stimulus to an economy.
Fair enough. On your point of consistency, I would wager that there is consistency in the Trump administration, but you won't like the consistency. The consistency is that there is inconsistency.
Well, and they slave to Project 2025. As I said, I never read it. I got the summation of Project 2025 was 20 pages or so. Yeah.
Not much of a summary there, right? But I suppose that's what the big question then becomes, because that is exactly what the focal point was at Jackson Hole, was now where do we go from here? Now, Fed Chair Jerome Powell and his team have clearly on numerous occasions claimed to have a lid on things. And in some cases, the data has suggested that they might. In some cases, the data suggested that they might not. And this is to your point, Si, that you made earlier on the fact that transitory keeps coming up as a word, and then suddenly it's not transitory. It's embedded and we need to deal with it. That relates to inflation. Now, the question is whether or not tackling this jobs conversation is going to be handled in the same light. Because let's be clear, the US Fed can't do anything to force people to hire more people or to create more jobs. And if you drop the interest rates so far down that they go back to whatever levels that we haven't seen in an effort to stimulate the economy, people might also choose, because people are allowed to make choices, choose to make different decisions. I think the pandemic has shown people different things, a different world of work, a different environment in which, I mean, coming out of the pandemic, people were willing to leave their jobs in America because they were like, well, I'm not going to work for this hourly wage rate, right? I'd rather not work. And we saw that in the number of unemployment filings that had gone up at a particular time, and then they started to come down and moderate. So I think not just America, I think the world over is making different decisions. For some people in the working class, for the blue collar workers, you don't have the luxury of being able to make some of those different decisions. But I think you're coming into an era where your younger working population, your Gen Zs, your Gen Alphas and all of that, might not have the same driving factors that drove baby boomers, Gen Xs, millennials in the working world. And I don't know if that's even going to be a factor in terms of how the US addresses this job conversation, but surely at some point it has to weigh in on some performance of the economy.
It absolutely does. And your point around the different generations is absolutely astute and spot on. But it is also how, and we spoke about this, we would have had this conversation 2 years ago, but not here because this didn't exist 2 years ago. But we would have spoken around how unemployment, even unemployment at 10%, you might not know anyone who's unemployed. In your immediate family of nine people, there isn't a 10th unemployed person. So unemployment is abstract. Inflation, everyone, even the rich folks are like, yo, look at that egg price. Scenario. So actually, I was doing the odd, man, if we could get eggs to there, sure. but it certainly is the sense of, and that is maybe also, you know, Jerome Powell throwing administration under the bus and leaving inflation, but I can't imagine he doing that. He also, you know, had nothing to say around central bank independence. I imagine that was happening in the corridors.
Well, some conversations are best left unsaid, and some conversations are for your last day in office, so you can leave it with a bit of chaos. Perhaps that's what Jerome Powell is waiting for, but that's where we're going to leave the deep dive. Let us know your thoughts around that. We'd love to know whether or not you think that the inflation conversation is indeed under control by central banks around the world, and whether or not they should be doing more. South Africa's conversation, we've had that as well. We've had conversations around what we are doing locally and what we should be or could be doing, but those conversations we'd love to get from you on our community chats, in our forums, in our comments. We love hearing from you guys. Until next time, that's the deep dive. And we're wrapping things up with Investor Insights. Thanks for staying with us up to this point. We are diving into, or at least sharing our insights around the South African Reserve Bank's decision to start closing down certain banks. This isn't a new thing. They initially started this by not renewing the exemption that was previously granted to Itala Bank. I've covered this previously on my radio show as well. But this time around, they're proceeding with the liquidation of the DCB Bank in the Northwest. That is the Ditsobutla Primary Savings and Credit Cooperative Bank. Now, in the past, these local cooperative banks have had use within provincial structures, within municipal structures. Itala in KZN, DCB in the Northwest. It's very interesting that obviously these terminations, liquidations, and all those proceedings are under different circumstances. We're not in any way suggesting that one is related to the other. But from a South African Reserve Bank perspective, I think the importance here is it seems to be centered around a couple of common threads. Things like internal controls, governance, operating practices.
Those have been flagged. To meet financial obligations.
Those have been flagged as some of the concerns on both sides there. And what that does is it puts a risk on depositors. It places a risk on the funds that are placed with these organizations. Now, in the case of Itala, the depositors themselves have come out to be concerned as well. Unions representing those depositors recently, as recently as last week, came out and said that their depositors have been unable to access their funds as well, right? So that is another real concern that South Africans go through is we've been told that we can put our money with this organization. And due to poor governance, due to lack of controls and those sorts of things, now our monies are at risk. And now what do we do?
So we do have CODI, and this will be the first time it's been used, Corporation for Deposit Insurance. So and they've had this in other parts of the world forever. So you have, your first 100,000 is safe. But the problem with banks, you know, if you go give money to a Dodge FSP or something like that, we can always say, ah, but hang on, weren't there red flags? Did you check with the FSCA? You know, all of those sort of things. How does an individual understand that there are significant governance failures within a bank? We can't, I mean, you know, we get there. We assume it's legitimate and it was legitimate. It had a license. I mean, all of those sort of things. And yet there was shenanigans happening in the background. Same with Itala, same with VBS. And for the depositor, for the individual or the corporate or the municipality or whoever, how do you get to know that? And that's what is so very, very troubling.
And to your point around that, Si, I think in as much as we can talk about regulated financial institutions and all that sort of thing, from a banking perspective, if you have a look at the requirements in South Africa to establish a bank, those are onerous is just, that's putting it mildly. It is not easy to set up a bank. So when people, South Africans, come in and say, hey, we've been told we can put our money here, and the organization shows you a banking license or an exemption from the SARB and all of that, it means then that you should have that element of trust, right? Mm-hmm. Now, we can get into the debate around whether or not the banking sector is exclusionary or not, how many banks control what percentage of the population, and all those other conversations. But the reality of the fact is when you have banks that have exhibited such poor controls, like DCB, like Itala, like the old African Bank, it doesn't bode well at all for wanting to transform the banking sector. When you have a repeat of the things in the past that have happened, and you start to look at them, and then you look at them and you compare them with something like a Capitec, you can have the conversation around, oh, but this is white monopoly capital, this isn't, and all of that. But the reality is, put all of that aside, people's monies are at risk.
Yeah.
And when you have the responsibility and you've been charged with looking after the monies of other people, you should not be taking any chances, no matter who you are.
100%. So then is there an oversight problem from the Prudential Authority?
That's another question.
Because, I mean, VBS was out and out looting. I mean, it was just a loot. Now, Itala, there was definitely some dodgy stuff happening there. And this new bank, you know, they just say governance issues there. They're not giving us a lot of detail. And you know what? Maybe the SARB has stepped in the nick of time for this DCB bank and is going to, you know, depositors haven't much been at risk, et cetera, et cetera. But then where's the PA, the Prudential Authority, in this in terms of, because that's all the public has, really, back to my earlier point, around knowing what's what. But you're 100% right. It is immensely difficult to get a banking license in South Africa, and so it should be. And it is exceedingly onerous and expensive in terms of compliance and regulation. emissions and capital adequacy ratios to run a bank in South Africa, and so it should be. This is people's, you know, lifetime savings. It's one thing if you get caught in a crypto scam. You were kind of hoping to triple your money by tea time so you can have a good dinner. Some of that's on you, you know, but you put your money in a bank to earn a bank deposit return. Mm-hmm. And you
for security as well, right? For security.
That's just which, that banks are deemed as safe.
Safe, right? Which brings another question here is, where then are you safe? Because we often talk about how banks charge forever, how banks have created a monopoly. You and I, Sai, have spoken about the premium, the risk premium that our commercial banks charge us on what the Saab loans to them in terms of interest. Yeah. Now, yes, there aren't enough banking players in the country. Agree.
Sure.
We could definitely do with more diversity. This isn't like the telco space where we want maybe perhaps less players. We might actually want more players here. But if we are to have a more inclusive banking environment and we are to have more banks that are able to serve the communities, then please, can we just manage them a little bit better? Because how then do we explain this? How then do we explain Itala? How then do we explain VBS? How then do we explain DCB? How then do we... Because these are real world examples where people have lost their monies.
So do we... I mean, is in perhaps not just a culture of... what's the word I'm looking for? Lawlessness, but it's the wrong word, but it'll do for now. In South Africa, in News 24 today, our previous police minister, here of the hat.
Becky Cele.
I was trying not to say his name. Becky Cele, yes, because he has a hat.
He has a hat. No, but there's a few ministers have hats.
So allegedly, he's phoned a gangster 10 times in a day and the gangster never picked up. Now, my first question is, with respect, if I'm trying to get hold of you and you don't pick up the first two times, I ain't phoning 8 more times. Now it's on you to phone me. But is there, I mean... We look out, and let's just go to Zondo because that's all on the public record. There's just sort of an impunity of lawlessness. It's one thing to be lawless. It's just the impunity of it. Because these things happen. There have been some prosecutions in VBS, not particularly many. Itala is still very, very new. It just sort of happens and we all just sort of move on and we forget that there are real world people who lost money. And I appreciate that the government stepped in and gave up to 100,000 to those who lost money. But there are real world people out there who lost money.
Mm-hmm.
And back to the earlier point, that was their safe money. That wasn't their risk money.
No.
It's one thing if my NVIDIA shares collapse because the results are horrible, but if my money in the bank disappears.
And that's the other thing, right? Again, I don't want us to make this conversation around race or any of those lines. It is about the fact that people entrust you with a certain level of responsibility and care towards you as the custodian of their money. Because as a bank, you are a custodian of someone else's funds, whether you loan them out or not, or whatever it is that you do with them. That is not your money, right? And that's what we need to remember. When running that organization, when running any other financial organization, as long as you're a custodian of someone else's money, act as such.
Yeah.
Act with responsibility and act in the best interests of that particular party. Now, we're going to leave that conversation on that note because we're going to update our wall and we're going to wrap up the show. On the wall today... We've looked at a couple of things and we've updated it. We've had a couple of things on there. We recently moved Sasol from liking where it's sitting at the moment. And I thought we'd take a look at some Eastern companies again, because alongside that, Alibaba is dropping results as well later this week. We have them on our wall. We previously had them as something that we liked on our wall.
Sure.
And I want to know from that perspective now, do we still have that sway towards international companies as we did? Because our local markets are performing well. Now, let's be clear. You've mentioned this before, Sai. Our local markets and our local counters, a lot of them are exposed to offshore operations. And so some of them can be considered offshore companies by and large, and not necessarily domestic companies. But when I look at markets like the Chinese markets, they're recovering, but perhaps not at the rate that people might be expecting.
Mm-hmm.
But they're also not doing horribly.
They're not. And I think, you know, they had the giant run September-ish of last year. And when I zoom out on Alibaba, it's trading where it was at 2022 or 2018, you pick your poison. I still think that they are cheap stocks, however. I do think, I mean, I'm just Alibaba for why not. I mean, price to book is 2, forward PE is 14. Okay, no dividend yield there. 0.85%, guys, get real. But I mean, the cash flow kind of collapsed in the last quarter. But they are good businesses, But here's a distressing fact. So I was looking at MSCI World versus MSCI All Country World. What's the difference? Difference is the country has some EM in. Did the EM add any uplift to it? No, it did not. It actually dragged it. So then I go and over 20 years, I put the All Country World, the MSCI World, the S&P 500, and the Emerging Market ETF. Mm-hmm. And the Emerging Market ETF has done like nothing in 20 years.
Really?
Emerging. So basically, if you haven't been invested in the US, sorry for you. There's money to be made. I mean, you know, 25 years ago when Satrix launched their top 40 ETF, it was trading at 6 Rand. Now it's trading at 95 Rand. Nice. I mean, very nice. 15 baggers so far. But emerging markets generally, and it's not necessarily because of lack of quality or earnings or any of those, because there are some quality emerging market companies. I mean, think ShopRite, think Alibaba, Bombardier, the airplane guys in Brazil, and others. Think around those. But it just hasn't translated into broad, I mean, you know, GDP in China. I mean, there's lots of good story. We just haven't seen it in the stock market. I still like Alibaba. Not
Should we then add perhaps an emerging markets ETF to our wall? And I ask that because that could potentially be one, a new addition to the wall, but something that speaks to, as you're saying, things have been undervalued. We've discussed valuations being stretched. We've discussed corrections potentially happening, but perhaps that could then bode well for something like an ETF like that.
Yeah. So do you want a local one or an offshore one?
Let's do a local one.
So there are some local ones. I'm going to give me half a moment.
We don't often have ETFs on our wall, but perhaps they're also good for diversification. In these uncertain times when markets are kind of trying to figure themselves out or trying to figure out what the next big move is, whether it's a retracement, whether it's continuation, or whether it's a bit of a correction, sometimes an ETF can provide you with a bit of a hedge because of how balanced it can be in its composition and how diversified it can be in terms of risk. So it might not always be the worst thing to have one if you find a really good one.
Should we go with an FNB one?
Okay.
FNB EMG, FNB MSI Emerging Feeder ETF. 0.33, not financial advice.
There we go. You heard that last bit. Not financial advice. Just our thoughts. Not any particular sway towards FNB. They did not pay us to put this on there. Even if they did, it doesn't guarantee that we'd put it on our wall. They could pay. Love it, Si. We wouldn't say no, but it still wouldn't guarantee that we'd put it on the wall. We cannot be bought. We will share our opinions.
And that interestingly then just holds the offshore one, which I was going to...
There we go.
EEM is the code.
Oh, there we go. So you've got a bit of a balanced kind of exposure there. Mm-hmm. So that's what we're going to be adding to our wall.
It is not financial advice. It is our thought and our opinion around that particular ETF. Please do your own research. Please speak to your own financial advisor. And please do not say Insider Exchange, Jim Sim, Simon Brown, Jimmy Moyaha, any of those individuals gave you financial advice, because we simply did not.
That's where we're going to leave the show for today, folks. Thanks for tuning in. If you've missed the conversations, you know where you can catch up on them. Before we go, we leave you with an unfiltered opinion of the week because, well, everybody deserves one, right? Those things are important. This week's unfiltered opinion. I thought about this morning. Now, I don't want it to be taken out of context, so perhaps let me preface this a little bit. I am not going off after anybody that uses this. Mm-hmm. If you use these, then by all means, use them. I find very little value in adding pronouns to your email signature. And the reason I say this is because in an email signature, if I'm sending an email to Simon, the pronoun doesn't come up when Simon responds. You don't respond to me in anything other than the first person, right? So Jimmy, Simon, hi Jimmy, hi Simon. Not hi he, hi they, hi she.
Yeah, fair point.
Right? It only really comes into effect. Pronouns only really are used when two individuals are talking about a third party, right? Mm-hmm. So Jimmy and Simon are talking about someone else. Then we use the pronouns. So in an
or when
email,
you're face to face, but yeah.
So in an email signature, when I'm sending an email and I've got my pronouns at the end of the email signature, you're never going to use those pronouns when you respond to that email to me. Think about it. No matter what you're saying back to me, as long as it's directed back at the sender, the pronouns are never used. You might say he, but then you'd be referring to somebody else that's mentioned in that conversation.
Yep.
So why do we have them in the signatures?
Well, why do we have signatures?
That's another unfiltered opinion. We're going to leave it on that note, folks. Remember, investing isn't hard. Just try it. The views expressed by the host or hosts in this show do not necessarily represent those of our clients, sponsors, partners, or guests, and should not be considered investment advice in any way. Similarly, the views and opinions of our guests and clients do not necessarily reflect those of our hosts or our platform. Nothing shared on this platform or any other platform affiliated with us should be read and construed as constituting investment advice of any kind on the part of Insider Exchange, any of its hosts, guests, partners, or sponsors. Trading and investing carry varying levels of risk and may not be suitable for all investors. Please ensure that you fully understand the risks and take appropriate care to manage your risk. We strongly advise that you obtain independent financial, legal, and tax advice from regulated professionals and institutions before proceeding with investment decisions.